Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today we've got an old friend, Dorothea Benton Frank, back on the Journal, and she's got a new book. This time, the Lowcountry geographical spot is Pawley's Island, and Pawley's Island is a character in this wonderful book. And we'll talk with Dottie Frank, but first, this NPR News Break. With me in the studio today is longtime friend of the Journal, Dorothea Benton Frank, whose new book, Pawley's Island, officially debuted on May the 6th, and within a week it was number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list. And Dottie Frank is sitting across from me just giggling, carrying up a storm. She just can't believe it. Well, you're writing about Pawley's Island. Tell us about the events of last week.
Oh, my goodness gracious. It's incredible, Walter, you know. I mean, I certainly picked the right title. You know, I just hope people think the book lives up to the title. You know, gosh, I mean, we've had, you know, book signings everywhere, and everywhere I go, there are just tons of people, and they're just so excited. And a lot of people have already read the book, which is wonderful, because now I'm starting to get feedback. You know, the book junkies, we love them the best. They buy the book, they run home, they read it in one day, you know, then they read it again. You know, so, and people like it, which is, you know, thank the Lord.
Well, you know, the last time you were on, we talked about the genesis of Shem Creek. You know, you were in Key West, and you ran into this woman who had thrown everything over in New Jersey and was operating this little film kiosk in Key West.
I never found her. I would love to find this woman and thank her.
Well, what was the genesis of Pawley's Island? Did you have a friend going through a nasty divorce?
Oh, I have more than one friend going through a nasty divorce. There, all of a sudden, Peter, my husband, the long-suffering, fabulous Peter Frank, my husband of 22 years, all of a sudden, we realize that there are probably a half a dozen couples that we know who are getting divorced, and it's just crazy. I mean, why do you get divorced after 20-something years of marriage? You may as well go the distance, you know, I think, but you know, I might kill my husband, but I would never divorce him. You know, he might kill me, but we would never get divorced. And they're behaving badly. It was shocking to see people that we know and love, both of them and their children and the whole thing, you know, act so badly in their divorces. You know, a lot of it's about greed, and a lot of it's about power, and it's about anger and
you know, punishment and all
of that. Yeah, all kinds of stuff going on. And I thought to myself, you know, the one thing that really, really bothered me in all of these divorces, and this didn't take place in all of them because a lot of them have grown children that are out of the house, but where, you know, this has been a trend in the past anyway, where the wife would say, you know, the husband wants the divorce because he's running off with the secretary, right, or something. And so he comes in and he says, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. You know, I know you hate me, and I don't blame you. And, you know, I'm going to leave you the kids in the house. And, you know, I'm going to give you everything I've got, and I'm going to do my best to take care of y'all. And, you know, I hate myself for this, but this is just how it is, and I'm sorry, right? But now there's a new trend called parental alienation syndrome, where the father works with the children for a year or two before he decides to drop the bomb and head for the hills to alienate the affection of the children away from the mother. And it's just, it's crazy. I mean, women for years have said, you know, oh, your daddy's a skunk because he ran off with so-and-so. And that's not right. You know, and now fathers are turning around doing it to mothers because mothers are working outside of the home, fathers working outside of the home, and the father's lawyers say to them, why is she any more entitled to the house and the children than you are? Why should you have to pay alimony and child support? You know, why don't you see if you can get the children to come and live with you? Because custody laws in South Carolina, like in many states, let the children decide which parent they want to go with.
At a certain age.
At a certain age. And in South Carolina, the closer you are to 16 years old, the more the court will listen to you, the family court judge will listen to the child, you know, and the child's preference, which I have to tell you, I think is horrendous because I consider myself a pretty smart cookie, you know. But when I was 15 years old, I couldn't have told you which parent was better for me. Why put the child in that position to have to pick?
Well,
I think the only thing that really is fair, I mean, if you have an extraordinary circumstance where you have like extreme mental illness or extreme cruelty or, you know, something, alcoholism, something going on in the home, that's a different thing. But to me, I think the only thing that's really fair is 50-50.
What you have in this case, if you talk about alienation, is the mother's the disciplinarian, so therefore she's a nag, she's difficult.
That's right.
And daddy gives them everything they want.
Party dad. Fun dad. Right?
So, well, divorce is not a pleasant topic, but somehow you manage to make part of it funny.
How do you like that? Imagine that.
And let's talk about your man, because you've got some good men in your book, but you also have a real rat.
Well, you know, he has to be really bad, right? I mean, you may as well, if you're going to make him bad, you may as well just go on and make him terrible. I mean, he didn't do anything that I haven't seen other men do. He just did it all. that's the difference. I mean, he's the whole darn laundry list.
Pawley's Island is the title of your book, and Pawley's Island is a place, it's really a character in the book.
It is. Absolutely it is.
And let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, why Pawley's?
Why Pawley's?
Why Pawley's? Why not, I don't know, Oak Island, right? I mean, the reason is that, first of all, I love Pawley's Island. I mean, I think that Pawley's Island is a lot like Sullivan's Island used to be 50 years ago. And it's even smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even a smaller island. And I love the idea of the continuum of, you know, houses being passed down through families generation after generation after generation. And what you learn on Pawley's Island is that the island doesn't care who's in the house. You know, you're going to come and you're going to go. So what are you doing with your time? And that's the whole thing. I mean, the island really questions Abigail and says, you know, okay, you're here now. Your father was here before you and, you know, his mother before him. And so what are you doing with your time on this earth? Why are you lying to yourself? What are you hiding from?
Well, and of course, Abigail was hiding from things.
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody does.
Yeah.
You know, everybody does. But she was hiding from things that were so large that she was crippled by them. Mm-hmm. You know, she's absolutely paralyzed.
You know, very successful attorney in Columbia.
Yep.
Her last name's Thurmond.
Yes. How do you like that? Maybe she's related. What do you think?
I don't know.
You never know around here anymore, you know?
And she gives up her lucrative practice and basically goes into exile at Pawley's.
Yeah.
In a summer cottage year-round, which can be a daunting experience because she is in an old Pawley's Island house.
In fact, I was in the house last weekend. The house where the story takes place is the Pawley's house on Pawley's Island that's owned by a lovely woman, Frances McElwinnan, and she allowed us to have our book party there, which was very exciting. And we had perfect weather and missed you and all that, you know. But it was just a beautiful evening, and it was really bizarre to walk through the house that I wrote about without even having ever been in it. Did I say that right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
You described a house, an old Pawley's house, and it turned out that was the house.
Right.
I mean, you'd never been there.
No, I knew it was the Pawley's house on the front end, but I'd never been in it. I'd been there and looked at it, and I thought, okay, this is the house where I'd like this story to take place. But I'd never been inside of it.
But it was a wonderful old-fashioned Pawley's house where you could sweep the sand between the floors.
Absolutely. If you sweep upstairs, it's going to come right down into your cereal. It was just great.
So Abigail Thurmond has several interesting friends.
She does.
One, a fellow who runs an art gallery.
Huey Valentine. We love Huey.
And his mama.
Yep, Miss Olivia.
Who is certainly a low country grand dame.
I am going to be her when I'm 85 years old if I get that far. I'm telling you, Walter, can I please be Miss Olivia? I love her.
Well, I think you're well on your way.
probably, right? I love Byron and Byron's little sister, Daphne. Mm. I mean, what a great crowd, right?
Byron is the butler / valet / major duomo of the household.
Right.
Of the Valentine
house. He's really
house.
Running two houses.
Yeah.
Because he takes care of Miss Olivia, too. And there's the whole thing about the power of the Waccamaw and the peace of the Waccamaw versus the violence of the Atlantic Ocean, which is true. I mean, you know, Abigail had her own hurricane going on inside of her, you know, and Huey was her friend who really always let her hide. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He let her hide. He let her come to the Waccamaw. It was sort of like going to church just to be quiet, think about things, look at the river. River keeps moving. Life keeps moving. You know, get yourself together. Let's go.
And then into their little ordered world, there at Pawleys. And by the way, Pawleys can be both sides of the creek.
Right.
We understand that.
That's right.
Even though Huey lives on the Waccamaw, he considers himself to be a part of the Pawleys community.
What I have found in my research is that everyone who lives within 50 miles of Pawleys Island considers himself to be from Pawleys Island. It's true. You know, it's such a wonderful place to visit and to be from. Yeah, I'd keep it's Sprawl. Pawleys Sprawl, I think we can call it, right?
This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dottie Frank about her new novel, Pawleys Island. Comes this, I almost call her a waif.
Yeah.
Just shows up in the art gallery with some paintings.
Poor old Rebecca.
This is the young mother who has been
abused and thrown out, chewed up and spit out, right?
Right.
Yeah. And how many people, though, Walter, do you know who all their lives, everybody told them they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that, they weren't good enough for this, they weren't good enough for that, until they believe it? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's who Rebecca is. I mean, she's somebody who has no faith in herself whatsoever, no self-esteem.
And yet she's a very talented artist.
But nobody believes that until she meets Huey.
Until she meets Huey, who is getting ready for an opening of, with, shall we say, a rather traditional low country genre painter.
Right. Which is great. I mean, that's great stuff too, sure.
Yeah. It's not quite paint by the numbers, but if you've seen one of their ocean scenes with sea oats, you've seen, you know, two dozen.
Yeah, the stuff causes narcolepsy. You know what I mean? It's really just nod right off. Oh, another beach path.
And he's very attracted to this young woman's paintings and puts them up and bingo.
Because they are powerful. I actually decided that Rebecca should be a watercolorist because of an artist whose work I love, a woman named Ellen Phelan out of New York. And I have one of her paintings that I bought, gosh, probably 20 years ago. It's a little watercolor of a doll. She had all these dolls, a collection of dolls, and she started painting her dolls. And she's a great friend of Elizabeth Murray's. And she painted one of the dolls for Elizabeth Murray for a birthday present. And Elizabeth Murray said, oh, you know, you should do a series of these. And so I bought one. And they are spooky, spooky. And so I thought, gosh, I've never seen spooky watercolors before. I've seen, you know, amazing, beautiful florals and birds and Anne Worsham, you know, Richardson and lots of other watercolorists whose work I love. But, Ellen Phelan, she's amazing. So I gave that bio to Rebecca.
Gradually, Rebecca's story comes out, but partially it comes out because Miss Olivia, being the Southern grand dame that she is, first of all, wants to know who Rebecca's people are.
Mm. Which tribe are you from?
Which tribe are you from?
Right.
And she finds out, of course, that she has a house on the Battery in Charleston.
Right.
And that she's running away from a bad marriage. And it just sort of, you know, this young woman who has kept everything bottled up inside her, it just sort of, it just all comes out.
Right. Well, first of all, nobody asked. Nobody seemed to care enough about Rebecca to ask her what was going on with her, except for her friend Claudia Kelly, who is in Atlanta, Georgia, who provides her with a condo in Litchfield where she can go and have a place to stay, because she's basically broke. You know, she has no assets at all. And, I mean, I know people, Lord, Walter, people getting divorced who the day after they decide to get divorced, the husband cuts off all the credit cards. Just some bad stuff out there, you know? I mean, you want to leave, leave, but can you please just be a gentleman about it? Anyway, old Rebecca, yeah, she comes to town, and Miss Olivia takes a look at her and says, okay, what's this girl's story? I mean, she's going to be handling my son's money in the gallery, so we have to know that we can trust her. You know, and she sort of, you know, Huey is definitely a mama's boy. Doesn't want to be bothered with that nasty business.
But Mama finds out the story, and then pretty soon, our semi-retired lawyer gets the story.
Right.
And
they all go to war.
They do. They go to war.
Yeah, to make things right. You know, and that's also a little bit of a story about doing what you're supposed to do and being who you're meant to be. You know, it would be just as bad if Abigail had stood by and done nothing when she could. That's a sin also.
But now she really wrestled with whether she was going to get back into this business or not.
Because it meant facing all of her demons. And she didn't want to do that, you know? I'll blame her in a way. I mean, I would like to think that she considered it before she, you you know, went to arms again.
Well, don't you think Huey kind of pushed her?
I think he absolutely put her on the launch pad and, you know, jumped on the other side of the seesaw and said, go, a little catapult. Absolutely.
Well, like I say, divorce can be very unpleasant, and you've talked about some unpleasant things, but there is so much humor as Abigail begins to unravel the story of Rebecca's ex. He's just a dumb dog.
He's a very dumb dog. Yeah.
I mean, he's skimming from his daddy's business.
Yeah.
Breaking IRS rules, cheating the old man. And he's fallen in love with this...
trashy thing.
Yeah, and I...
Who at the end of the day really isn't?
No, she's got True Grit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the old honor among thieves thing, you know?
I guess that... I don't really like the term, but that's what the people understand. Trailer park trash. That's what she's depicted as.
Well, she never lived in a trailer, but she's definitely trash.
Yeah, she is bad. And I mean, not that she's stereotyped her, but I mean, she's got the big hair and bad accent, bad grammar.
Right.
But she doesn't have the figure that he wants her to have.
No, so they fix it.
They fix it.
They enhance this and they lift that. And
she becomes a robotic woman.
Yeah, she's sort of bionic. Yeah, she definitely is. She has, you know, she's probably good for another 300,000 miles. She has so many new parts.
Well, I think that is when...
It happens all the time, Walter. It happens all the time. And the thing in there about the father promising his young daughter... augmentation surgery to improve her chances of becoming a cheerleader also happens all the time.
Wait a minute, are you serious?
I'm serious. I went on the internet and I looked up all these statistics on plastic surgery performed on teenagers. Most of it, you know, are rhinoplasty, nose jobs, you know, but and some of it is laser surgery for your eyes. What do you call that surgery?
LASIK?
Yes, LASIK surgery to correct nearsightedness. But there were something like 600 cases in the year that I looked at, which I guess was probably 2003, of breast augmentation surgery performed on teenage girls under the age of 18.
Which means they had to have parental consent.
That's right.
That's just right. It's not only amazing, it's just really, mind-numbing, disgusting.
It's like, what has the world come to? What has the world come to? I mean, it's like, how low can we go? It's awful. Absolutely awful. And you know me, I am not a prissy thing. I am not a prissy woman, but I have problems with these things. And on top of that, I mean, what kind of a woman breaks up a family, steals the husband and the children? What kind of a woman does that? I mean, where are we going here morally in this country? You know, it's a real problem. I have a problem with that kind of stuff.
Rebecca's wandering spouse is not the brightest bulb in the pack.
No, but he was her bulb.
He was her bulb. He and his remodeled honey. Mm. I think it's interesting that he sells automobiles because he's taken this used car and buffed it up and changed the odometer. And,
yeah, he sure did, didn't he?
and he hires a real sleazeball attorney.
Oh, they're out there, packs of them.
And then they begin to flirt with breaking the law.
Right.
And think they can get away with it.
Right. These are bad guys. And there are plenty of bad guys out there that'll do lots of things in the name of money. Mm-hmm. Look at Enron. I mean, you know, it's all over the place.
I would love to have you read the passage where the judge threatens the honey with removing part of the assets.
I would be delighted to. That's one of my favorites. Where is this now?
The passage that I've asked... our author to read is the testimony of Charlene, who is the girlfriend, and the judge's reaction. And this is where I say, yes, a divorce case can be funny.
Okay. Charlene shot the judge a look, and Judge Shelby was so entranced by the story she was hearing that she blew off Charlene's careless use of the word hell. Maybe she agreed with her. So, we may assume that the relationship is over now, I said. You may assume that for sure, but there's something else to say that you didn't ask me about, which is, that house spooked me. Everywhere I looked was his wife something or other. I would say, oh, aren't those towels pretty? His daughter would say, my mom embroidered them, Or I would say, oh, this is such a beautiful Afghan. And his son would say, my mom made it. There was so much stuff in that house of hers, it would never be mine. Even these beautiful murals of birds in the marsh that she painted on their dining room walls. Besides, that house was hers, and the whole plan Nat had was just greedy and nasty. He's a terrible man. The courtroom was silent as everyone took it all in. It was the first time I had ever had a hostile witness who actually wound up testifying for my client. Thank you, Miss Johnson. We may have to call you again, so please stay in town. Oh, I ain't going no place. I wouldn't miss this for nothing. I nodded my head. Your witness, I said to Albright. Your Honor, we have no questions at this time. Then you may step down, Miss Johnson. The defense would like to call Dr. Claudia Kelly. Nat and Albright looked around to see who Dr. Claudia Kelly was, and in minutes, it was all revealed. Claudia took the stand, and after the requisite questions, she explained in her most professional manner that the sum total of all of Charlene Johnson's surgical procedures could well have exceeded $50,000 to $60,000. I entered the receipts I had found into evidence and made the remark that these were marital assets, of which my client was entitled to half. Poor Charlene. She had been a good girl for as long as she could. Charlene jumped up from her seat and began screaming as loud as she could. If you think you're getting these back, you can forget it. These boobs are mine, and these teeth are mine, and this fanny is all mine. Go get your own, because there ain't no way. Whack, whack, whack. Judge unamused Adrian spoke. Miss Johnson, sit down and be quiet. Let me tell you something. Your plastic surgery bills are the most offensive use of marital assets I have ever seen in the entirety of my professional career. Normally, insomuch as the definition of normal applies here, your improvements would be evaluated and 50% of the cost of the surgeries would be awarded to the wife. But if I hear one peep from you, one peep, I will order half of them literally removed. This court is in recess for lunch. We reconvene at 2 o'clock. Here comes the judge. I actually called my friend Robert Rosen down in Charleston, you know, who is a divorce lawyer, and asked him what he thought about, you know, could that happen? And he said, heck yeah, anything can happen in a court of law. That's the judge's courtroom, and she can say and do whatever she wants. So I said, okay. You know, so, and then I checked it with Judge Bobby Mallard, who was the head of family court in South Carolina for many years, and he said, absolutely. He said it would be unusual to say something like that, but, I mean, it could be said.
Charlene is, I don't want to say the comic relief, but I think she is in this instance.
She is. Poor thing.
And
you know.
And she sinks that jerk that she's been running around with.
It's like Dumb and Dumber, the two of them.
I know you read your last book, Shem Creek, and I gather it was not a happy experience.
I read Pawley's Island, not Shem Creek. Pawley's Island is the one I read on tape, and it is a misery. People should go and buy this on tape only because I will never do it again, so it's going to be maybe like a little bit of a collector's item, and it's probably the worst recorded book in all of history. I'm telling you, Walter. It was the worst experience. It was the hardest thing I have ever done. I have the greatest respect in the world for the worst audio narrator. Honestly, my tummy made so much noise. You know, you get in this booth. You've done this before, so you know. You get in this booth that's so quiet, you can hear yourself getting old. You can hear your hair growing, you know. And I'd said to them, like Jo Humphrey was telling me she did this too. She said to them, look, I'll read the book on tape, but it's going to be, you know, an author reading. It's not going to be a dramatic presentation because I'm not an actress. And I said, I told them the same thing. Same thing happened to me that happened to her. You get in there and you say, so Charlene Johnson shows up and blah, blah, blah. And you hear, you say, the producer comes in and says, we hear a little noise there. Would you mind starting over from so-and-so? You start over again. And then he comes in, excuse me, Miss Frank, would you mind putting a little more emphasis in that voice so we can tell this character from the other? And the next thing you know, they want you to act. And you, I can't act. That's not what I do. You know, so it's pretty bad. So go buy it. People will be torturing me with this thing in my old age, for sure.
Well,
it was some experience.
But at least you pronounce things right. Poor Pat Conroy in Winning Season, where
Edisto
and Beaufort, South Carolina.
Happened to me, too, in Plantation. The last line of the book is, it's the Edisto. It's always the Edisto. But what do I get to listen to this hayseed, right, saying, it's the Edisto. It's always the Edisto. I wanted to. People were coming up to my sister, Lynn, and saying things to her. You know, I listened to your sister's book on tape. Is she mortified? I wanted to die. Yeah, of course I was mortified. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. After this break, we'll continue our conversation with Dottie Frank about her new book, Pauli's Island. Welcome back. This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and we're talking with Dottie Frank about her wonderful new book, Pauli's Island. Why is it these people, whether it's, you know, the folks up in the great North Midlands, whether it's Wisconsin or Michigan, wherever it is, they seem to think they have all the answers on how things should be pronounced? And
you know, I don't know. I think it's not them. I think it's the readers and the guys who are producing it. They don't know the difference, you know. So, I mean, I gave them a pronunciation guide, and she just ignored it. The reader just ignored it.
Well, Pat said he did the same thing.
Yeah. And guess what? It was the same reader. We had the same reader on both of those books. Yeah, we're going to find out where she lives. I'll make her listen to my book on tape. That'll be punishment enough.
Oh, well.
Oh, golly.
How did you feel when you opened up the New York Times and found out less than a week after your book hit the bookstores, it was number 9?
I almost died, and it happened in a phone call. Actually, I'll never forget it for the rest of my life. I was in Winston-Salem.
Well, tell us about that.
Oh, gosh. I was in Winston-Salem. It's sort of like, you know, that was the town where we changed horses yesterday. You know, you drive up, and they drop you off in a day hotel, and, of course, the people at the desk look at you a little funny when you say, I'm only going to be here for a few hours. It's like, okay, honey, whatever. Anyway, there I am with 19 suitcases because I'm on the road for so long. But anyway, I'm in this miserable hotel room with nothing to do for 3 hours. The place is under construction, so there's not even a coffee shop, you know, and I've got the New York Times, I'm working the crossword puzzle, and I'm reading everything that's in there, and waiting for the phone call. You know, the list comes out on Wednesday. It's not going to be printed until, you know, 10 days from now. It's not this Sunday, but the following Sunday, you'll see it in the paper. I think it's May 20th or something. But anyway, this is a May list, and so, you know, to come out in May, I wanted to come out in May so that I didn't have to go on book tour during hurricane season like last year, which was unbelievable. But coming out in May has other issues, such as everybody and their dog has a book coming out for the summer. So May is like May sweeps in television, it's May sweeps in books. And I never even thought about that because I'm not that smart about this whole thing. I've only been doing this for a few years, you know, and I've never had a May book. So to come out in May and to make the New York Times list at all is nothing short of miraculous. I mean, I was stunned. Stunned. I mean, I broke out into this huge chill, and I had these goosebumps, you know, just like big goosebumps. And then I broke out into this like sweat glow, I should say. As a southerner, right? I broke out into a big glow, and I almost cried. I was so surprised, I couldn't believe it.
You had some pretty hefty competition.
Oh, kill yourself! James Patterson, Nicholas Sparks, Suman Kidd, Da Vinci Code, Harlan Coben, Mary Higgins Clark, Alexander McCall Smith. Just, you know, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And Da Vinci Code's still there.
You know, I can't believe everybody in this world has not read that book yet, okay? I mean, take your money and go home. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm thrilled for Dan Brown, and I love the book.
Mm-hmm. And Sue Monk Kidd's new book, The Mermaid Chair.
She's fabulous. What a great gal she is.
Another South Carolina?
I'm telling you, all the good literature comes out of the Southeast. The best stuff, I think.
Yeah. Well, now you
my humble opinion.
Dottie, there's nothing you ever did that was humble, dear.
Okay, I'm sorry, Walter. Oh, God. I'll try to work on that.
You have gotten to where you're producing a book a year now, just about.
Yeah.
But your books are not formulaic.
No, they're not.
I mean, this isn't, you know, and I like John Grisham, but his books all have a, you know...
A similar ring. Yeah.
The only thing similar about yours is you have chosen the Lowcountry landscape as a character in your books.
Yeah. Well, Walter, this is really simple. Why? If I wrote a book about Butte, I'd have to go to Butte. I'd be spending a lot of time in Montana. I don't want to go to Montana. I just want to come back to the Lowcountry. So if I place my books in the Southeast, I get to come back to the Southeast.
And you do have a place on Sullivan's Island.
I do, thank God, in this heaven. Yes, finally, my husband bought it for me.
And you have a child at the College of Charleston?
I do. She just finished her freshman year. She's doing great. She loves it. She says, I'm never leaving Charleston. I said, okay.
Now, what about your boy?
What about my boy? He's great. He's going to be a senior in high school this year. Just took his SATs. Had the essay, you know, part, the new writing component of the SAT test.
Is he looking at South Carolina schools, too?
I can't get William to come out of his room. So I don't know where he's going to go to college. And, you know, I think I might have to go with him. I think we're looking at the College of Charleston for him also, and maybe some other smaller schools around South Carolina.
And so then you and Peter can move here permanently.
Well, you know, we probably would never live here permanently because he likes to travel and he has business interests in New York. But we'd be here certainly more often, maybe half the year, which would be wonderful. I'd be thrilled. So I miss it here, you know. All that sunlight, it's good for you.
Well, how much time do you spend here each year, really?
Well,
Is this just fun time you come here, or are you writing when you're here?
Oh, I'm writing when I'm here, too, and I'm doing research when I'm here. I even started paying taxes in South Carolina this year, just for the fun of it.
That's serious.
I know, it's very serious.
Well, the way your books, our Board of Economic Advisors just reported that income receipts were up 10%. You're probably a big part of that.
I don't know about
that. Two books.
I don't know about that. Gosh, no. I'm probably here close to 4.5-5 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I find an excuse to come down between my daughter. And I just went on the board of the South Carolina Coastal Conservation League, which is a big deal. And, so they have 4 board meetings a year. I get to come to those, which is wonderful. And then my daughter I'm on the Parents Advisory Council at the college, so have to go to those meetings, you know, have to come.
Well, your roots are beginning to sink in.
I'm trying hard, And Peter actually finally has made some great friends here, and so, you know, he's amused. He has things to do when he comes now.
So we amuse him.
Yeah. Oh, no, he has a great time.
Talk about your writing, because it's not easy to produce not just a book, but a good book. Every year.
God, thank you, Walter. No, it's not. I have no life. I mean, this year, the reason that this book is out so quickly after the other was, well, first of all, it was half written when I went on book tour last year. And so I had to just finish it when I got home in September. But I can tell you that pretty much I did not get up out of my chair from September through December except to put a turkey in the oven on Thanksgiving and roast beef in the oven at Christmas. I mean, that was it. And now I'm working on a new book, and I have the luxury of a little time now. So I'm taking some time off and going on vacation. And
you write on the computer, right? You
don't... I do. Okay. I work on a word processor.
Okay.
But I take notes. You know, I have a little book with me all the time. I'm always filling it up with nonsense and gathering up things, clipping newspaper articles.
Well, of course, there's always good subject matter here in South Carolina.
Boy, you can say that again.
What's your next book going to be titled?
Oh, gosh. My next book is not in the Lowcountry.
Oh, heavens.
I know. It's not. I just felt like, well, you know, I've done that for 5 books now. Maybe I should do something else for another book or two, and then I'll come back to the Lowcountry. It's in Atlanta, Georgia. Not too far. Mm. But it actually takes place all over the world because the protagonist is a travel agent. She plans special events for corporate executives and their families, and so she travels all over the place. So it's not about her desire for one particular landscape. It's about what all these different landscapes do to her. That's one part of the story. She's in northern Italy at Lake Como and Napa Valley. Mm. And... Lord, help us and save us, Las Vegas and Mexico City.
Charlene would have been perfectly at home in Las Vegas.
I think she would have. She would love those little outfits.
Well, everything
but it takes place in Hilton Head also, and Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah.
When we started off, I asked you, was there an incident or a person that got you started on Rebecca, like there had been the woman in the kiosk at Key West for Shem Creek? Was there somebody that... you thought about for either her or for Adrian?
In my new book, or in this book?
In this book.
This book, well, Judge Adrian Shelby is actually named for a friend of mine who is one of the most dignified women I've ever known in my life. Mm. And so when I think of a judge and who would be absolutely, completely appalled by someone like Charlene, Adrian Shelby came to mind. So I just named the character after her. And of course, she got a big kick out of it. Mm. But Everett Presson, who's in here, he's the private investigator. He's a great friend of mine from Charleston who's a fabulous real estate broker. So he's a good guy. He loved this because he gets to be, you know, the manly man and do all these crazy things in this book, which is a lot of fun for him. He's sort of the adventurer. But no, there's no one particular character for Rebecca. But, I mean, I guess they're all out of my head, you know.
Yeah, so but there wasn't an incident. You know, you didn't have an epiphany like you did at that kiosk in Key West about this young woman who had thrown New Jersey over to come south.
No, this was just a collection of moments and discussions over dinner with my husband where he'd say, listen to this. So-and-so called me today and listen to what he did to his wife. Or his wife just called me, and she's appalled and all upset and crying because this is what he did to her. And what's the matter with these people? It's like they turn 50 and they all go crazy. So, you know, it's a combination of a lot of events.
Okay.
I guess Abigail's me.
You know, Abigail's you?
Yeah, they all sort of are. But I think, you know, if I was an attorney and I had a chance to turn somebody's life around and get their house back for them and their children back and all those things, I would certainly want to do it. Mm-hmm. I liked Abigail's courage. I wanted to make her brave, you know, and she was brave. Rebecca was brave, too, because she put herself in Abigail's hands. And that trust, I think, is, you know, really huge.
But it was a trust that had to be earned because there were several times. I mean, I guess one of the things I really liked about the characters in this book is that they do have their foibles. They do have their doubts about one another.
Sure. Well, don't we all?
But had this been a real Beach book, everybody would have been Donna Reed and Perry Mason, and everything would have ended up just beautifully with no disconnects along the way, no doubts.
Yeah, well, I think Beach books have changed. You know, I mean, I think it's time for them to change anyway. I mean, we've had this discussion before that, you know, after I read, you know, I don't know, whoever I read, Jane Smiley, you know, there was no one that I really wanted to read that was writing smart, funny, accessible fiction. All the other stuff out there was dumb to me. You know, I didn't want to read it.
Well,
you know, we're trying to raise the bar a little bit here, Walter.
Even though you may be marketed as a Beach book, as you may have known from that really nice review you received in the state newspaper.
Which was fantastic.
My
mother could not have written a nicer review.
Well, and it was written by, she wouldn't have. And it was written by a librarian, which is even more important.
Yes, I'd love to take her out to lunch.
I mean, she said this is not a beach book.
No, it's not.
It's not a beach book.
No, but I'd be very happy if you buy it and take it to the beach.
Oh, it'd be great to read at the beach, sitting on a screen porch with a nice, cool beverage.
Cover. Did you love this cover?
Yes, the Polly's Island hammock.
Yeah, this is my great friend, my old childhood friend, Jack Alterman from Charleston, took this picture. Mm-hmm. Actually, don't tell anybody. Can you keep a secret?
Yeah.
It's Sullivan's Island.
Well, you just told 30,000 people.
Oh, you think
Sullivan's
so?
Island.
Oh, no, they won't tell anybody, will they? But it is a Polly's Island hammock. I think the color is beautiful.
Yeah, the color is beautiful. And you didn't have any trouble convincing your publisher that you wanted to have Polly, you know, this particular cover?
A little bit of a problem, but we got it all worked out, you know. They wanted to have people on the cover, and I said, no, you don't understand. Polly's Island is about solitude. You go there to be with your family. You go there to be quiet. You go there to figure things out. You know, a Polly's Island hammock, people see this book in the stores, they're going to say, Polly's Island. There's Polly's Island. Oh, we used to have a hammock like that. Or I went to Polly's Island when I was a kid. Or my grandmother used to go to Polly's Island. And it's going to mean something to them. You know, if you make it just look like a beach book with girls walking down the beach or something, that's ridiculous. People look at this and walk away from it. And I don't think this is a book just for women.
No, it's not just a book for women.
No.
You know, and this is another discussion that we have had, and we've had the same thing with Cassandra King and Mary Kay Andrews.
Isn't she great? She's fun, isn't she,
Mary Kay? Yeah, she really is.
Yeah, she's a great gal.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dottie Frank about her new novel, Polly's Island. Publishers now, though, are marketing. Those of you who are women writers, they want to market everything as chick lit.
My daughter, who still has her teeth, amazingly, remarked to me one day, Mom, I'm reading Polly's Island. You know what you're doing? You're writing chick lit for like old ladies. I said, shut up. Shut up. But you know, in all her wisdom, she's a teenager.
But again, it's not. It's, you know, and I have recommended to a lot of my male friends. I said, you know, read Hissy Fit.
Right, right. She's hilarious.
It's a great Southern book.
It is. Here's the telling thing, okay? I went into, I got here last night at, almost 12 o'clock at night, and I hadn't had dinner, big surprise. So the only place that was open in my hotel was the sports bar. So they had chicken fingers and some other things that I could order. So I went in the sports bar, and I just had this phone call a few hours before that I made the list. And I said, there were about 10 people in the bar, and I said, okay, this is it. I'm buying everybody a drink. And they said, why? And I said, well, I just found out I made the New York Times list with my new book. And they were like, oh, gosh, you know, congratulations. That's a wonderful blah, blah, blah. Because Robert Jordan, you know Robert Jordan from Charleston, mm-hmm. writes all the science fiction books. He said to me, I said, what do you do when you make the list? Because he's written like 22 New York Times bestselling novels. It's just incredible. He said, well, first I do a little happy dance. And then I go down to the local bar and I buy everybody a drink. And I thought, well, that's a great idea. So I went to the bar last night. I said, I'm going to buy everybody a beer. So I bought everybody a beer or whatever they were drinking. And bartender said, what's your name? And I said, I'm Dottie Frank. And he said, is that the name you – I said, well, I've got like a whole big name. Dorothea Benton Frank is, you know, my real name that goes on the books. He said, what did you – do you write Sullivan's Island? I said, yeah. He said, I read Sullivan's Island. What a great book. And I read Shem Creek, you know, about a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And this other fellow on the other side said, wait a minute. I got a house on Isle of Palms. Did you read Isle of Palms? I said, Jason, I read Isle of Palms. I started laughing. I'm like, all these guys read the book. It was great. Just great.
Well, see, I think that tells you something that the focus groups in New York don't understand.
They don't understand. No, they don't. There are a lot of things people in New York don't know, Walter. You'd be amazed.
No, I wouldn't. Tell us some more stories.
Well, I'm just sort of like my own little cocktail napkin. You know the cocktail napkins down here that say, we don't care how you do things in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're making one for me in New York that says, we don't care how you do things in South Carolina, because I'm just wearing those people out.
Well, what about your agent? Is she helping you wear them out?
Oh, gosh, I have a new agent. I have a new agent. My editor left her job after she just had another baby, and so she decided to become a literary agent. So I said, okay, you know, I don't want to lose her. Mm-hmm. So we rise together, right? Mm-hmm. The boat in the ocean. Her name is Gail Fortune. Good name, right?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Now, you have, you're gal. Staying with the same publishing house.
Yes, though. Yes. I just finished my contract.
How many new books did you obligate yourself for?
Well, we don't have a new contract yet, so we're in the negotiating mode at the moment. Who knows? I don't know. Probably two, I guess. I mean, that's the normal thing these days, right? Two? I don't know. What do you think I should do?
Well,
we could discuss that.
I
Who knows?
I put it in the hands of your agent and let her see what she comes up with.
Yeah, I guess so.
Assume that the advance is sufficient.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I have not turned in the proposal for my new book yet because we were waiting to hear about the list. Now we've got the list. I'm like, okay, time to turn it in.
Now's the time to get the contract.
That's
the
it.
Advance.
That's right. That's right.
So when you made that, who gave you the call, your agent?
The president of my publishing company, Leslie Gelbman, called me from New York yesterday.
And did he tell you how many copies had gone out of the warehouse?
I think right now we're at 170-something thousand. So, which is respectable. It's not huge. I mean, it's not like, you know, a James Patterson number, but it's a big number.
Well, I know
hopefully they go back to press now.
I know my friend Tom Warner was so excited when you had your coming out party there at the Pauley's house, is that he sold 500 books that night, which for them was just...
I know, because I signed them. Look at my poor little fingers here. Anyway.
You know, and
shocking.
He and his wife, Vicky, are figuring out how many hundreds more to order for the rest of the season.
It was very funny. It was very funny trying to figure it out. Because you don't know. You know, you don't know if everybody ran out and bought it the first day just because they wanted to be the first one to have it or they wanted to get it right away or, you know, how many people stayed home or how many people are still coming down on vacation that are going to buy it.
Well, the season didn't even open down there yet.
Right. Right. We're doing okay, right? I think this book might have some legs for the summer. I hope so.
Well, I would think so. And I'd be willing to bet that also it's going to be on people's Christmas list next year.
I mean, I hope so.
This is a book that's going to, again, the title, you know, the others have Low Country, you know, Sullivan's Island's great, Shem Creek is great, Isle of Palms, but Pauley's is a very special place, even to people who haven't been there.
I know.
It's almost a mystical place.
No, it is a mystical place. It is one of the few places left in the Low Country that really is magical. I mean, first of all, you've got all this supernatural stuff that goes on there with the Gray Man and Alice Flagg and, you know, I mean, and I believe everything. You know me. Pray to everything it can't hurt might do some good, you know? And the Gray Man and Alice Flagg are in this book, you know, so they have little walk-on roles.
And Walter Edgar's Journal had a drive-on role.
That's right. That's
Thank
and
you very
Marlo,
much.
You're very welcome.
Yes.
Mr. Marlowe's store, too.
Yeah, you've got Abigail driving down U.S. 17 listening to the Journal.
That's right. Because it's the best thing to listen to, Walter. It's a great show. It is. I love it when I come down and I'm in Charleston and I can pick you up on the radio there. You know, I'll hear your voice doing a little ad, or sometimes I'll pick up the program if it's the right time, you know. And I love that. I go, that's Walter. It's great.
Dottie, how about reading? You mentioned the Gray Man because you give him a walk-on part. How about reading that passage for us?
Sure. Sure, let's see. Let me start right here. Okay. Over time, meteorologists had distorted our perception of danger because no one worried anymore about a storm unless it had winds in excess of 150 miles an hour. But you can take this to the bank. If you don't think it's frightening to drive even a heavy SUV in driving rain and wind of 50 miles an hour, try it sometime. Category 1, Category 2, it wasn't the number that mattered. By the time they stuck a name on the storm, it was time to plan for another place to sleep and higher elevations, or make sure you had plenty of nerve, batteries, and water. Julian opened the door to the front porch. Julian, don't go out there. I just want to watch for a minute. The ocean's almost up to the dunes in some places. I'll put on a pot of coffee, I said, and decided not to watch him be skewered by a flying palmetto frond and die a miserable death on my front steps. The phone rang. It was Huey. Abigail, I know you just ate here last night, but I need you to come for dinner again tonight for two reasons. One, I have 100 quail in my freezer, and if we lose power, I don't want to lose them. And two, the storm's going to make landfall, somewhere between here and McClellanville. They said we're supposed to get terrible amounts of rain, and I don't have the nervous system to worry about you all night stranded on a sandbar. Please, pack your things and come. Rebecca's already here with the children, so stop. Okay. What? Did you say okay? Why, I can't believe it. I'll tell Byron to make a cake. Julian loves quail stew, and so do I. See you soon. I poured two mugs of coffee and turned as I heard Julian's footsteps. What's wrong? I said when I saw the look on his face. Abigail, I think I just saw a ghost. Male? Yes. Wearing gray? Yes. How did you know? Did he look at you or the house? Both. Okay. It's safe to go to Huey's. Honey, you just saw the gray man, and the house is going to be fine. Screw Gaston. Let's pack.
And because if the gray man looks at you, then you're going to be okay.
You're going to be okay. And I left out this little word here.
Yeah, there's some words we can't read on the air.
That's what I figured.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The other passage that I noted, you had it. It was in at least one or maybe two of Mary Kay Andrews' books, and it was in Mamie Garvin Field's memoir about growing up in the Lowcountry, and that is always wearing clean underwear. And it's for men and women, but you know, just
I don't know. You never know. If you get in a car wreck and you go to the hospital and you're half dead, you don't want people to see you in your raggy underwear.
That's
my mother always said that.
It has nothing to do with race or class.
No.
It's you don't wear raggedy underwear.
No, you do not. You do not. But you also can't bring yourself to throw them away, so you try to figure out what to do with them while they pile up in a drawer.
Yeah, I have this discussion with Betty because I've got these wonderful old T-shirts that are so soft and wonderful, and I've got they have a hole or something in them. I said, nobody's
polished furniture.
No, I want to keep wearing them.
You're so funny. You're so funny. Well, you never know.
Well, I don't care if I have a hole in my T-shirt, but my wife doesn't want people to think that I go out with
She's right.
Holy underwear.
No, that means you're very religious, right? I don't know. Oh, gosh.
Dottie, a state poet laureate, Marjorie Heath Wentworth, wrote a poem just for you to use as a epigraph for this book, right?
Incredible. And it's beautiful.
Had she read the book so she knew what to
no,
write?
No, she had not. We had a brief conversation about the story I wanted to write. And for the third time in a row, Marge wrote a poem that perfectly matches the story, the spirit of the story. And she had never read the manuscript.
Well, I'm going to read it. The poem is called Tangled. We return to hear the waves rolling onto the beach, one after the other, connecting us like blood. We were listening long before we came here, remembering wind spinning salt through interrupted sunlight. This is a place where dreams return as fish bones tangled in seaweed. Whatever sorrows come are folded into the sea, rinsed clean and kept. Unbearable secrets.
Isn't that something?
That gives me goosebumps.
Me too. Every hair on my body is standing up on end.
Since I've read the book, and it captures the spirit. I think that's what, since we're talking about Polly, the spirit.
She is an incredible
essence
talent
of the place.
Yeah.
And we are very fortunate to have her as our poet laureate of South Carolina.
And I am very fortunate to call her my friend. She's a great gal.
Yeah, she is. Dottie, we're about to run out of time. Anything you'd like to share with our listeners before we sign off?
Gosh, I'm just grateful. You know, I appreciate everybody's support very much and people coming out to book signings and listening to this crazy interview, you and I together again, chatting our heads off, and I just I hope they enjoy Polly's Island. I really do. I hope they think the book lives up to the title.
Well, I think it does.
Thank you.
And Polly's really is, I would say, the main character. Without Polly's, the book's not there.
That's right.
It's a very special place.
It certainly is.
And this is a very special book, and I want to thank you for being with us today on The Journal.
It is a huge pleasure, as always.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal as much as I did. Dottie Frank is a native Carolinian. She spent a lot of time away, but she really is becoming, again, one of us. And as always, she's a delight. And in this most recent book of hers, Polly's Island, she has truly captured the spirit of that wonderful place. Because Polly's Island is magical. Once you cross the causeway and get there on the beach with the dunes and the roar of the surf, it is truly another world. And because it is another world, it helped transform the characters and shape the plot of what is really and truly a beach book. But believe me, folks, the writing is far, far superior to that. But I recommend it for this summer. Get on that screen porch, listen to the surf, get the sand between your toes, have a nice cool beverage, kick back, and enjoy Dottie Frank's Polly's Island. If you missed any part of today's journal, or would like to listen to it again, go to walteredgarsjournal.etvradio.org, and you can listen to it online. That's walteredgarsjournal.etvradio.org. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.